And welcome, everybody. It's midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. We'll begin today with another edition of our monthly Health Watch series with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Nguyen. She stops by once a month to talk about the frontline public health issues affecting the Baltimoreans that we all know and love, as we affectionately call ourselves, as well as folks in the region. Lena, it's good to see you.
Nice to see you, Tom.
Thank you for jumping in your canoe and paddling up here from downtown. I appreciate it. And before we get going, congratulations, you've won an award. The American Public Health Association, which is a huge health advocacy group, awarded you the 2016 Milton and Ruth Romer Prize for Creative Local Public Health Work. That's terrific.
Thank you very much. I feel like I have my dream job. I am so fortunate every day to work with this incredible group of public servants in the Baltimore City Health Department. We're on the front lines every single day, working with our most vulnerable individuals in our city, protecting the health and well-being. And I'm so thrilled to represent us. And we strongly believe that we're transforming Baltimore into the model of public health across the country and the world. And this award is testament to the work that we're doing to flip the narrative of Baltimore, that people should not look at us as what's happened in our past. And yes, there have been decades of disinvestment and poverty that have led us to where we are, but we're also doing a lot to transform our city. And it's great to see the health department recognized in this way.
Yeah, it's great for you and your team. That's terrific. And, you know, just awards in general are nice. They're just nice. I mean, for example, people used to just call me an idiot. Then I won an Emmy about 10 years ago, and now I'm an award-winning idiot. And it's much nicer. I mean, I take that as an upgrade, you know? So, you know, congratulations and enjoy it, you know? So let's talk about some of the things that are going on in your world and in our world as well. The Zika virus. Yesterday, Congress, after 32 weeks, I believe, when the president requested emergency funding to fight the Zika virus, they finally approved not quite as much money as he had requested. I guess it was $1.1 billion and he had requested $1.9 billion. So what does that mean? So here we are. The summer is basically over.
Right.
Where do things stand with that? What's this money going to do?
Well, I'm glad that Congress has finally approved the $1.1 billion for Zika, but it's been a revelation that public health has to beg for funding to protect the health and well-being of our residents. It's not right for us to have to justify every time when an emergency occurs. I mean, these are disasters that could have spread. And in the case of Zika, as we've talked about before, we're talking about the lives of our unborn children. And in our communities that are already the heaviest hit by disparities, who could be affected for generations to come. It's not just a matter of money. It's also a matter of ethics that we've had to wait this long for funding to prevent something that could have really cost society so many more billions of dollars. And so it's a reminder that we in public health have to keep on beating that drum of talking about not only the cost of a program, but also the cost of inaction. This is this money will still be needed because we still have to build our public health infrastructure. We have to prepare for next year. There's a lot more work that needs to be done for vaccine development, for science. But I think this also underscores the need for a national public health budget that is not just for when crises occur and then we get funded many weeks or many months after, but there needs to be the flexibility for local public health departments to access these funds instead of having to beg every time an emergency occurs.
It's not unusual that Congress would take a long time bickering about things having nothing to do with the Zika virus, which is what happened in this case. There was a Planned Parenthood codicil that was attached to the bill that, you know, made many Democrats vote against it. There were other things having to do with the water in Flint, Michigan, having to do with Ted Cruz had an amendment wanting to change, you know, who regulates internet domains and stuff. I mean, everybody throws in their, you know, pet projects and these things, and it just gets all confused with the actual the actual thing. So it did take just an extraordinarily long time. This has happened before, like Hurricane Sandy. There were people who weren't willing to allocate money to, you know, for flood relief. What were the effects here in Baltimore? I know you had to divert some resources over the summer that you just, you know, you didn't have because this funding hadn't been approved.
We saw that Zika is a crisis in slow motion, that it is a global public health emergency, as has been declared by the World Health Organization, by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We reallocated other resources in the city. Mayor Raleigh Splake reallocated $500,000. We in the health department, along with other city agencies, reallocated our staff as well and pulled them away from other important projects, including fighting the opioid epidemic, including HIV, other things that are very important health issues in order to battle Zika. And I think it, again, underscores that public health is something that saved your life today. You just may not know about it. And that's why it's so important for us to fund for public health, because these are not issues that we see for until potentially years later, or the consequences may not be issues that we see for years later. The national budget for public health between 2008 and 2015 has decreased by 8%. And it's because it's not front of mind. And that's why it's so important for all of us to talk about not just the cost of that program, but the cost of prevention, the cost of doing nothing.
So do you have a sense of what portion of this $1.1 billion may accrue to the city of Baltimore, and what you'll be able to do in the health department moving forward against Zika?
I am hoping that the $1.1 billion will be allocated to areas of greatest need that include our urban centers. It is inner city areas like Baltimore City that would be the heaviest affected by Zika. It's our areas that may not have air conditioning, that may not have screens on our doors and windows. The Aedes mosquito tends to live in areas it breeds in standing water, which accumulates in even something as small as a bottle cap. And it's our areas that have high vacant properties. It's our areas that are already the hardest hit by disparities that really need this money the most. So I'm hopeful that the allocation will be done in a way that's given to areas of greatest need and not just spread evenly throughout the country and the state.
I know a lot of it's going to go to Puerto Rico. They have the highest number of cases in the country. Some 86% of them are located in Puerto Rico. New York City is also getting a lot, and I guess many of the cases there have been transmitted from people traveling to places like Puerto Rico and other Caribbean countries. You know, folks hear this number, $1.1 billion, it seems like a lot of money, because it is a lot of money. Is it the fact that, or is it the case that, for example, the health department might get a grant from this allocation of money, and you would actually be going and, you know, putting screens on people's windows, putting doors or boarding up vacant houses? Is that the kind of thing? I mean, how does the money actually get spent?
The decision about where in the country that money is going, I do not believe has been made. Most likely that money will go to states, and then it will be up to the governor of Maryland and the state health department to decide how much will come down to local jurisdictions. And it is, again, my hope that the governor and those who are making decisions about funding will decide to provide funding to those areas like ours of greatest need. This occurs for Zika. The same can be also said about issues like opioids. Hopefully, we will receive funding from the federal government for fighting our opioid epidemic. There are more people in our city dying from overdose than this year than last year. We are facing a 50% increase throughout the state. But the areas that are hardest hit are areas like Baltimore City. And the resources coming from the federal government should not be spread evenly throughout the state. Mm-hmm. It should be distributed to areas of greatest need. And this is what is going to move the needle across the state. This is what is the most ethical and humane thing to do. And this is what is scientifically proven also to be the most effective.
Because we did spray this summer, right? I mean, we had some spraying going on in the city and elsewhere throughout the state. Are you confident that that spraying, you know, worked, that the plans we were able to put into effect with the limited resources this past summer, what's your take on their efficacy? Are you happy with how that worked? I mean, what's the state of our Zika epidemic here in Central Maryland?
The best test for efficacy is the fact that we have not had any cases of local transmission of Zika by mosquito here in Baltimore City. We have had cases of Zika. These are cases of individuals who have traveled to other country who then were infected with Zika there and came back. We have implemented, together with our city, state, and federal partners, a protocol that has been very effective in preventing Zika. And this is something we're very proud of in the health department. This is our bread and butter. This is something that my team has been working tirelessly on for months in order to prepare. We've been preparing for this since January, when we realized that Zika has been is likely and possible to come to Maryland, and we are prepared for it with the limited resources that we have. But again, it has taken away from our other key priorities, and it is something that we are hopeful for additional resources for, because it's not reasonable that we continue to do whack-a-mole, that every time an emergency comes up, that's when we start looking for funding. We know that this funding issue exists. We also know that there's a huge issue with us in the city not having enough funding in general for many critical areas, including for preparing for emergencies. You can't just respond to an emergency if you don't have the resources to prepare for it. And this is something that I am, that I and public health leaders and really all of our residents and constituents should be concerned about.
So just one more question then about Zika, just to finish up. This isn't too little too late, the fact that this funding finally gets approved 32 weeks into the game. I mean, there still is an opportunity to be preventative for next summer. Does the mosquito go away and die at the first frost? I mean, are we worried about mosquitoes for the next month or so, month and a half, before we get that first frost? Is that the case?
Mosquito season, we're still technically in mosquito season, so I would still encourage everyone to use to be inside when possible, when they're going outside, to use EPA approved repellent. And certainly it's really important that if you are a pregnant woman and you are thinking of traveling to another country, please visit the CDC website at cdc.gov and look for travel recommendations, because there are countries with active Zika transmission ongoing. There is no active Zika transmission going on in the continental U.S., but in Puerto Rico, as you mentioned, and in other countries, there is active local Zika transmission. Very important to heed those recommendations.
And the transmission is either by the mosquitoes, it's sexual intercourse. I mean, there are a couple of other ways. Very quickly, the Guillain-Barré syndrome. Mm-hmm. Is that another risk besides, obviously there's a risk to pregnant women with the issue of microcephaly, but Guillain-Barré, is that something that concerns you as well?
Guillain-Barré is also called ascending paralysis. It is a very frightening disease that I've seen in my medical practice in the emergency department, when somebody literally becomes paralyzed, and it can extend so far as to stop someone's breathing, because the diaphragm is a muscle as well. Guillain-Barré is a rare complication of Zika. It is certainly one of the reasons why we should be aware of Zika and prevent Zika. But the far greater risk is for the pregnant woman, because of the risk of severe brain damage in that child.
And that's why. All right. We'll take this up a little bit more when we come back. Dr. Lena Nguyen is Baltimore City's health commissioner. She's here in our studio for the monthly Health Watch conversation that we hold each month here on Midday. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll take your calls, your questions, and your comments. But first, we'd like to take a minute to talk about how important it is to support the programs you hear on WIPR. Andy Bienstock and Sheila Cast are standing by with all you need to know about becoming a member of your public radio. And thanks, Andy, and thanks to everybody who has given in this fall membership campaign. We really appreciate it. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Looking ahead on this broadcast, coming up on Midday tomorrow, we'll examine the surge in admissions at the state's HBCUs, the historically black colleges and universities. We'll talk with a researcher and admissions director at Coppin State University and a student about some of the reasons why more students than ever are enrolling at these predominantly black colleges. We'll also have some live music in the studio. A couple of guitar players from Hot Club Baltimore will stop by and play a few tunes in the style of Django Reinhardt. On Saturday, they'll be appearing at the first ever Baltimore Jazz Fest in Druid Hill Park. That's tomorrow on Midday. And coming up a little later this morning, or this afternoon, rather, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will have her review of the new show at the Everyman Theater. But now we turn once again to Dr. Lena Wen, the award-winning Health Commissioner of Baltimore. You're welcome to join in the conversation. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780. It's a little confusing. That's a different number than the number you call to pledge. 410-662-8780 to call Midday. Also, you can send us an email, midday@wypr.org, or you can drop us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall. By the way, Dr. Wen is hosting a community conversation tonight at 6 o'clock at the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum on East North Avenue to talk about the Healthy Baltimore 2020 initiative, and we'll talk about that in a second, Dr. Wen. But first, let's talk about a $5 million grant that the city has received through your office and your good work on this from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. Didn't know there was such a thing, but I'm glad there is. And they are giving $5 million over the next 5 years. And this is in addition to a $2.3 million grant from the Department of Education. So these are specific grants for specific things. What are you going to do with the money?
I am so glad to discuss this topic on your show, on your award-winning or the award-winning show with the award-winning Tom Hall. When I first came to the city, I had an experience that really changed my perspective on what we should be doing and how we should be viewing health in Baltimore City. I remember meeting with this group of 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, and just speaking to them about what they thought were the major health challenges in our city. And I thought that they would talk about smoking or food or whatever it is that they had heard about. But instead, they all talked about one thing, which was mental health. And I couldn't quite...
Mental health.
Right. Eight, 9-year-olds. Some were 10, 11, 12. They never said the words mental health.
Sure.
But what they talked about was trauma, and this trauma of not knowing whether it's safe to walk outside, not knowing how to tell someone that everyone in their family is addicted to drugs and isn't getting up in the morning, so why should they have to get up in the morning? Or the trauma of eating, to being dependent on meals at school because they don't know what food options are going to be available at home. I mean, it was just this profound sense I got at the time that we can't just be speaking about physical health without addressing mental health. And we can't talk about mental health without addressing the deep trauma that people face every day. And that it's not appropriate for us at all to look at individuals simply as the victims of violence or the perpetrators of violence without also recognizing how trauma and violence, there is this intricate cycle. And that it is our job in the health department to break that cycle and really call out the importance of trauma, the importance of emotional well-being. If we see a child who has abdominal pain, maybe they don't have appendicitis. Maybe there's something else going on with that child and it's our job to figure it out. Maybe we shouldn't wait until that child is diagnosed with a mental illness, that there's a lot that we can do to recognize signs and to prevent trauma from happening in the first place. And so after the unrest, it gave us particular impetus to look for opportunities to address these issues that have been there, but we may not have had the urgency to address them. Or even there was so much stigma surrounding mental health and trauma, but I think the unrest, the riots gave us even more of it. It gave more voice to these issues. And so our communities came to us and said, it's time for us to look for opportunities. And in particular, not in a top-down way, that our community specifically said to us, you can't tell us about what is our experience of trauma. And therefore, you also do not know about the solutions that will be effective. You know, we may know, or we may think we know based on our evidence and science from other areas, but you know what? They may not apply to Baltimore City.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of people talk about like PTSD being mm-hmm. prevalent in underserved and impoverished communities, the same kind of PTSD that people might have suffered from, you know, their experience in Iraq or Afghanistan, but maybe it's not the same kind. It's still PTSD, or it's still some sort of traumatic, it's a traumatic experience for a human being, but there are nuances to traumatic experiences.
It's also a feeling of lack of safety. It's something that's so basic to many of us who may have the privilege of living in areas where we feel safe coming home every day. But I've feel disingenuous telling a parent that their child has to exercise when they don't feel safe even walking outside of their house? Or how can I tell individuals who are experiencing homelessness to focus on emotional well-being or on physical well-being when they don't even have a place to stay? And so that's what we wanted to focus on. We wanted to talk about how can we be responsive to our community's understanding of trauma, and what is it that they can teach us? What is it that they want and we can bring the resources to bear? And so we've been working for months with community organizations, also with our federal legislators, on looking for grant opportunities. And we specifically applied for a grant from SAMHSA, from our federal government.
That's the agency that deals with substance abuse and mental health services.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And the grant that we applied for specifically said, and we've never applied for a grant quite this way because usually grants are very specific in how the money is going to be allocated. We specifically said, we don't know how this money is going to be allocated. The health department still has to be ultimately in charge and accountable of how the funds are spent. However, we are going to have a community advisory board that's going to be elected from the community to decide what is it that the money is going for? How are we going to help our communities that are the most affected in West Baltimore? This grant is targeted to West Baltimore. And what can we do to not just see our community partners as a checkbox of people that we have to talk to, but we're going to completely flip the narrative of trauma. And so in combination with that, we also have this Department of Education grant that is going to city schools. And Dr. Santelise, the new CEO, has been a fantastic partner. We're going to be expanding mental health services so that there is a full-time mental health clinician at our target schools. And also we're going to provide trauma trainings for every individual in our schools who will ever come in contact with any of our students. That way they'll know to understand, to recognize, and then treat the effects of trauma. And I think it's a powerful way for us to change the narrative of Baltimore and of what is happening in our inner cities around the country.
Great. Let's move to the phones. We just have a few minutes left with Dr. Nguyen. Lena Nguyen is my guest today. It's the Health Watch show here on Midday. We're going to turn to Anne in Baltimore. Anne, they tell me you are a doctor. Welcome to the show.
Yes. Hi. I've worked for a fair bit of time in Baltimore City at the state, county, and local levels, and really appreciate the work that Dr. Nguyen is doing. Just wanted to throw out a thought, and it may or may not be redundant to what's already been done or is contemplated. But, you know, so often, as she mentioned, we do not have sufficient funds in public health to meet the needs, either for an acute situation, or for a more chronic situation. So the concept of a foundation is sometimes useful. CDC has a CDC foundation. I know Baltimore City has the Baltimore City Foundation. Frankly, I'm not very familiar with the functions of the Baltimore City Foundation. But just to throw in the notion that Maryland is the wealthiest state in the nation, we should be able to do better in public health. Can we, in some manner, either tap a foundation which might be really powerful in meeting our needs in times of deficit, like what we just went through with Zika, or create one on the state level or, you know, in some other manner?
Yeah.
I'm also familiar with the fact that we have some excellent foundations in Baltimore City, like ABLE.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for your comment, Anne. Of course, you get your funding sometimes for specific grants, for specific programs, and then obviously from the allocation in the city budget. What do you think of that idea?
Well, I cannot agree more with Anne that that public health needs to be funded at a much higher level than it is now. That we should not just be looking at the cost of a program. We also have to look at the downstream effects. I mean, we always have a choice to be made. Is our choice that we're going to invest in incarceration, or are we going to be giving our children the best opportunity when they're born? Studies have shown that nurse home visiting, for example, something as basic as visiting the pregnant mom, and when the child is in their infancy, that will improve educational outcomes and will reduce the chance of violent activities later. We have a program for glasses for children. That's something so basic as giving every child a pair of glasses that we also believe is a violence reduction program. And so how that's our choice to be made about where that money is going to be spent.
Yeah. But it's all interrelated, isn't it? Yeah.
It's all interrelated, but we have to think about the cost savings down the line and not just the cost of that intervention at that point in time. And I think it's a choice for us to make. Do we want to invest upstream before the bullet can even have a chance of reaching a person? Or do we want to spend millions of dollars treating the individual, which of course I believe as an emergency physician that we have to treat people once they receive an acute injury. But what can we do to prevent that injury from happening in the first place? I will say that I am very proud of our health department here in Baltimore City. We are over 80% grant funded in our $130 million budget. I have extremely resourceful staff who are great at getting funds, and our local foundations have also been very supportive of us.
Yeah, and we're on a roll when it comes to getting these grants from the federal government and the Department of Education, and that's a credit to you and your staff. So terrific. Always great to see you. We will see you next month. Thank you so much, Lena Nguyen. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the Health Commissioner of Baltimore. It's Health Watch here on Midday. Dr. Nguyen joins us once a month to keep us up to date on the issues that affect the health and well-being of Baltimoreans and others in the region. A reminder that Dr. Nguyen will host a community conversation tonight at 6 o'clock at the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum on East North Avenue. That's about the Healthy Baltimore 2020 initiative. And so I encourage you to go over to National Great Blacks and Wax tonight and join that conversation. We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick will join me with her weekly theater review. But first, it's the final day and indeed the final hours of our fall membership campaign. Thanks to everybody who's joined in and helped us to advance the mission of your public radio. We really appreciate it. If you've been waiting to step up and make a pledge, no reason to wait any longer. Here's Andy and Sheila. They'll tell you how easy it is to become a member of WIPR.